following podcast has adult themes and some strong language.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2, or Episode 10 if you count episodes. Although Halloween was a special, so does that even count? Let's stick with the tried and tested formula of season and episode number. Although I am British, so is it even a season or a series? And just checked, it's called a season on the podcast site, so it's season. That's a minute of your life you won't get back, and supposed to be the easy part for me. This week we are talking about London for reasons that will become clear later. Author Samuel Johnson said, "If you're tired of London, you are tired of life." I have never been so far tired of London. My relationship with London started fairly young and are tied up with memories of my Nana Garner, so I need to talk about her. She was my paternal grandmother, my role model, and one of the best people I ever knew. As I've discussed before, my maternal grandmother died before I was born, and my maternal grandfather left her when my mother was 2. Nana and Grampy Garner were both in their 40s when Dad was born, so were close to 70 when I was born. My grandfather died when I was 2, a few months after Owen was born. I don't remember him, but I have lots of pictures of him. Apparently, he adored me. With my dad being an only child, I was his first grandchild. I'm confident that for the first 2 years of my life, I was surrounded by love and attention. I really wish I could remember it. I had the knowledge that Grampy had gone to heaven as long as I could remember, but have no clue when I was told this. I don't remember my life changing at all. I think my family are incredibly good at hiding their sadness. Nana was therefore a huge figure in my life. We used to visit her often, and she was so young in her outlook. She used to play with Owen and me, I mean properly play with us. Run around after us, bounce us around and make life fun for us. After the crash, she was everything to me. I was 9 and had lost my dad and brother. My mother was in hospital and then rehabilitation for months, close to a year. I lived with Nana during that time. She put up with my temper tantrums, my anger and my tears. She never patronised me and told me everything was going to be all right. She just listened and repeated over and over how much she loved me. She also told me about other things that opened my eyes to the world. We talked about different countries, cultures and people. She taught me about literature and cinema. We visited museums and galleries, not just in Cardiff. On the weekend, we would pack a bag and visit other cities in the country. Even when I moved back in with Mum, we would catch a train to London and visit the sights. The first time I set foot in a London theatre was with Nana Garner. It wasn't even a pantomime, and I loved it. Not so much the performance, but just being part of it. We would walk in Regent's Park, feed the birds in Trafalgar Square, and visit the galleries. Not too long, though. Used to set a time limit of an hour so we could see what we wanted to before leaving. It meant we never got bored. I got the feeling it was for her as well as me. We travelled on these trains, which were under the ground. They were really fast and they just kept coming. You'd miss one and another one would be around in a few minutes. Everyone in central London was interconnected thanks to these trains. As you can guess, London was a magical place for me. It still kind of is. I get that's because I've never lived there and London is a different place based on where you are. I still get that buzz though when I walk into Leicester Square with all the sights, sounds and people. It was an incredibly dark time for me when Nana died. She was healthy and mobile for someone her age, but she died suddenly in her sleep. My mother said at the funeral that Nana was the last connection to her late husband. There was no one left to tell her. That would be me. I have a lot of my Nana's stuff still, old photos, documents and letters to my grandfather. At the time she was just my Nana, but now I know her to be this incredibly clever, decent and loving person. Even in the worst times, she could make me laugh. She had this whole life I knew nothing about because I only knew her for 15 years and I was too young and stupid to ask. I know she was born too early and would have enjoyed a bit more independence as a woman. Not that she had a terrible life. I have some amazing memories of her and was incredibly lucky to have been the granddaughter of Elizabeth Dorothy Garner. Every time I go to London, I take a little piece of her with me. It's a head in a jar. Designer Vivian Westwood said, there's nowhere else like London. Nothing at all. Anywhere. I know she meant that in a good way. I'm still speaking to my writer retreat friends. It's only been a few months, but I still hadn't imagined developing any relationships following a retreat. They are like my sunshine at the moment. Everyone is so upbeat and positive about their craft. Oh, I keep doing that in my mind. They are the writers and I am the fraud. It's a hard habit to break. We have a Discord group set up, so we chat and set up goals. It's to hold us accountable and make sure we write. I'm currently doing a no negotiation 1 hour a day of writing. I'm getting up earlier to make sure I do. Who am I and what have I done with Jess? I feel a lot happier after doing this. It doesn't matter then if I tell myself I would just watch one ep of the big new TV programme and end up watching the whole series in an evening. I won't feel guilty. Because other days I dispense with the TV and just write. Even reading is good. Stephen King says if you don't have time to read, you don't have the time or the tools to write. Reading is actually working, so there. For people who write for the screen, watching TV and films is also research. I need to get on that one next. Lauren from the group is a screenwriter, and not only that, she has one of her scripts made into a film. It's an indie film and hasn't got a distributor yet, but it's just a matter of time. The premiere was at the Prince Charles Cinema by Leicester Square. She was actually one of the worst of the group for imposter syndrome, which really goes to show. A week ago, she jumps into the group all excited. Some tickets have been released for a premiere and she would love, 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 love for us to go. My initial reaction was no, it was on Saturday and it was already Wednesday. I couldn't possibly go to London on that short notice. Answers started coming in almost immediately. Most of the people lived in London or at the commuter distance at least. People were jumping at the chance. The first meetup since the retreat, which felt like a lifetime ago. Out of interest, though, I checked out the train cost and it was definitely out of the question. I was so disappointed. I really wanted to see the film and, more importantly, those people again. I couldn't know, not with work the way it was. There were two left to answer, Tyler, who was in Manchester, and me. It was ridiculous. London wasn't that far. Then it suddenly occurred to me there was always National Express. And there it was, my way to the big city. £10 non-refundable one way. Okay, that was doable. And there were similarly priced tickets for the way home. I could go there and back in one day. I bet people were going out afterwards, though. It wouldn't have harmed to look at a hotel. I'm glad I did because there was a budget hotel so close and okay, I shouldn't be planning a London visit if I could be out of a job soon and the cost of everything was ridiculous and I will be knackered all week and I have this thing and it just went on. I could find a million reasons why I shouldn't go and only one good reason to go. Because I wanted to. Tyler answered he had booked a hotel. Lauren wrote, well, there's only one person left to reply. Jess. I replied immediately with, what time are we meeting? The excitement wore off on the 3 hour, 10 minute bus ride into Victoria Station. It was a really smooth service though and not uncomfortable. It's just 3 hours, I sat there doing nothing. I had a notepad and pen, but staring out of the window seemed so much more preferable. I'd also conveniently forgotten about the travel costs from Victoria to the hotel. This ended up being more than the entire ride from Cardiff. When I got into my little hotel room, though, with air conditioning and a double bed, I also wondered what I was doing. The room was perfectly nice, but what was I doing? I quickly showered, changed, and made my way towards Leicester Square. When I saw the other people's lovely faces, I knew I'd made the right decision. Now, the premiere. I don't want you to think it was a big red carpet affair with barrier security and Tom Cruise on hand to ring your mum. It was a perfectly normal cinema affair. More jeans and a nice top than wearing the latest Versace number. Not that Versace would ever dress me. They would take one look at me and send me down Primark. We all settled down in the cinema and I luckily remembered to turn my phone off. The film was immense. I know it's the old expression, but I did really laugh and cry. Proper emotional roller coaster and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a bit different, a bit bizarre in a very weird and wonderful way. I'm not saying this because Lauren might hear it. It genuinely is good, and I am in awe of her. It's called Demolition Charlie and should be coming to all good cinemas and all streaming services soon. Everyone was deciding which restaurant they should go to, but Lauren followed out and invited us to a post-premiere event at a nearby club. No one was missing out, so off we traipsed into Soho for drinks and food. It was only when I got inside and got a drink that I took a breath. I got off my arse, come to London, watched an amazing film which I normally would have missed, and now I was sitting in a private room of a famous club in London which shares his name with a famous brother. I did this. As I sipped the champagne, I noticed everyone around me were reaching for their phones. "Am I that boring?" I asked Scott, who sat next to me. He replied, "Just checking in." "There's no one to miss me," I said, but reached for my phone anyway. I switched it back on and the beeping started. "Someone must do," Scott said, smiling at me. Made me look like a tool. There's a text from my friend Ems, actually three of them. Then another from my friend Izzy asking where I was, and Ems was worried. I hadn't heard from Ems for about a week and a half. Then a voicemail came through. It was Ems. "Where are you? Ring me straight away. I'm worried." I found myself a quiet corridor and rang her. I told her I had my phone off because I was at the cinema. She gave out this big, exaggerated sigh of relief. "I wondered why you weren't answering. Where are you?" "Soho." She wasn't impressed. "Soho. Soho. As in London Soho. What the hell are you doing in London?" She was on the warpath, and I had no idea what set her off. It felt like I was getting the brunt of it. I kept my voice as calm as I could. "Told you, I went to the cinema." "What, like there are no cinemas in Cardiff? Only Odeon or Cineworld or Everyman? Even Showcase is not that far." She'd missed that view, but I wasn't ready to argue with her. "It was a premiere only shown in London. Lauren, one of the people from the retreat, wrote it." There was a pause, and then she completely lost it. Did I know how reckless I was being, just disappearing to London without telling anyone? I could be in danger. I barely know these people from the retreat. All sorts of things could happen to me. I could still catch COVID, still be really ill from it. I was utterly selfish and always thinking of myself. Timing of it couldn't be more perfect. I had spent a week in work hearing that. And then, just as I was getting to relax, just as I was getting to the point of telling myself that I was actually okay, I hear my best friend telling me what a complete and utter tosspot I was. I didn't know what to say. I couldn't even speak. On the one hand, I was told I was lovely from the people here, and from Wales I was hearing I was a bitch from hell. There is no fight in me. I told her to have a lovely weekend, hung up, and pushed it onto flight mode. Normally I could fight it off, deal what was in front of me and the rest later. But because I'd gone from such a high to such a low, it hit me hard. I managed to find the nearest toilet before the tears started to fall. I didn't know how long I'd been there when I heard someone come in and call my name. I knew the voice but couldn't place it. I told the unknown person I was fine and I'd be out soon. I hadn't been in there crying the whole time. I wasn't the drunk person at the party. I'd been there now trying to calm down. I was in a film premiere after party in the centre of London. Wanted to at least look like I was enjoying it. My eyes had stopped being puffing. I was about to go out and reapply my mascara when I was so rudely interrupted. "Scott sent me to find you. Said you'd been a while." It was Millie. The voice was Millie, the woman who'd run the retreat. I flung open the door because I couldn't believe it. "There you are," she said, and opened her arms out to hug me. I willingly followed her instructions and I immediately felt better. I could still feel the warmth from the hug when we broke away from each other. Told me that she missed the film, but she was never going to miss a party. Millie didn't push me and stood with me as I put my mascara on and led me out. There wasn't much food, but plenty of champagne, so I was quietly buzzing after three or four glasses. I told Lauren how much I loved the movie, and she introduced me to the director and a couple of the producers. They couldn't have been nicer. The actor playing Charlie arrived, and I knew her. Not personally, but she is kind of well known in this country. The director took me directly across to meet her and I thought she would be a diva, but she wasn't. She was warm and funny and within minutes it felt like I was talking to an old friend. I didn't feel once that they didn't view me anything other than an equal. At that point, it was like, M's who, and I'd completely forgotten about the phone call. Later, Millie took me aside and told me I knew how to work a room. I think it was meant as a compliment. She told me she wanted to speak to me because she had finally listened to my podcast. She didn't so much say she loved it, but she loved that I'd done it and I was far braver than her. Then she told me about another call she was running about imposter syndrome. Full day this time and I should go. I said I would love it, but I couldn't justify the money at the moment because my life was so fucked up. I think I did actually use those words. My defences were down after the alcohol. She told me that she thought I would really benefit from it and she wouldn't even take payment for it. I was part of the Writer's Retreat family now. Then she asked me why I thought my life was fucked up. So I told her. Oscar Wilde said London is full of fogs and serious people. Whether the fogs produce the serious people or whether the serious people produce the fogs, I don't know. See, I don't think that's necessarily true. Last week at work had been especially bad. Monday I was home, so I was protective on the barrage of hate. Still had the emails to deal with. I'm not going to name names here because there are implications. The main reason why I'm recording these but not releasing them as I go is I can't. Legally, that is. Or maybe I could just delete these parts later, but I'd be one of those people just teasing. I hate that. Something really, really exciting happened. What? I can't tell you. Then just shut up and tell me nothing. I digress. The emails were getting accusatory, as if everything that was going wrong was my fault or I was purposely holding back information. Again, I was home, I could deal with it. Tuesday and Wednesday I was in work, but I deliberately went in early. The last thing they should have done was given me keys to the premises. I'm still skirting around this, so I'll try and tell you as much as I can without actually telling you. You see, what I was struggling with at the beginning was how could this person, let's call him numbers guy, be stealing from the company. It didn't look like money was being funneled off to other accounts and the payroll looked as I thought it should. In other words, there were no imaginary staff members or partners of the managers who were earning a good salary who hadn't even stepped foot in the place. I knew though, I just knew something wasn't right. I worked in manufacturing long enough to know. I mean, he was so nice to me when we spoke. He even covered the Cardiff factory a number of times, so it's not like I didn't know him. When Cardiff closed and I was transferred here, he was nice to me. We share an office. The more questions I asked, though, the more defensive he was. Just asking to see the accounts. It's part of my job. It's not checking up on him. The sly comment started. I must have known where all the bodies are buried to get given this job, not even a proper job. I was just given it because I know something, or I was sleeping with, insert name of person here, some even in the US who I'd never met, so it was quite impressive. After that, it was because I really didn't understand accounts. Leave the hard stuff to the big boys. It took me a while, actually more time than I'm proud of, to realise he wasn't working alone. There was another person, probably more, that were working with him, probably on the floor. So getting to the factory early was evidence gathering. This also meant that it was 2 long days being hit with vitriol. All I could do was put my head down and get the work done. I couldn't wait to go home and back to my story world. My main character was having a tough time too. Thursday is my half day at the office. Oh, they love that. Being told I was part-time going home for the day. It wasn't even original. I somehow managed to time it when a load of staff were coming upstairs for lunch. The talking amongst yourselves when you're actually talking to me is not clever or funny, by the way. I heard a lovely one on Thursday. It was someone from Works on the Floor called Katrin. Katrin is in her early 30s, pretty, and has a tongue that could sharpen knives. She said, if I was that ugly, I wouldn't even leave the house. It's not even how bad I am at the job now, or how I think I'm better than them, or how I've got a chip on my shoulder. Now it's just I'm too ugly to be out in public. The numbers guy was behind me and he didn't even pretend to hide his snigger. I got home, put my favourite music on before starting work again. Maybe I should have negotiated another half day from home. Maybe I will. Let's pretend for a moment that the too ugly to leave the house comment didn't hurt. Let's even forget that people hating me there was a big problem. I now had strong suspicions and a little bit of proof that people were stealing there. If I raise my suspicions, what happens then? Am I going to be responsible for people losing their jobs and an economy nosediving into recession and the worst cost of living crisis in years? Maybe it's not that much money. Maybe those people needed that money just to pay their electricity bills and I'm being a dick about it. It could destroy their livelihoods. The other part is, what if I'm wrong? I could destroy my own livelihood. I could never work again. How would I cope? There was nothing straightforward about this. I had to make a decision fast though, because if it keeps going, I am complicit. That Saturday, I spent 3 hours on a coach staring out a window trying to make a decision about work, and another 30 minutes telling someone I barely knew about work and my life. Millie was a kind and considerate listener though, quite easy to talk to. The fact I was even talking to someone wasn't like me, and it may have felt good to talk, but it also felt deeply uncomfortable. It wasn't just work though. There was that phone call from Ems, but there was the other part of it as well. I didn't feel close to Ems and Izzy anymore. Remember, I consider them my family, not just my friends. So when you know something isn't right, what do you do? It started during the pandemic, even before I recorded the last episode of the podcast. But after I got COVID, it felt worse. There are three things here. One, I was struggling to get physically healthy, whereas Ems was struggling with a bad episode of depression, and Izzy had been told she stopped producing eggs, meaning she was never going to be the mother she desperately wanted to be. We were also, like most people, struggling with the absolute mindfuck that COVID had been and was continuing to be. It almost felt like we couldn't be there for each other because we didn't have the energy and capabilities. We needed to care for ourselves. The difference being they had partners and I had no one. Contact had become less, and when it was, it felt more like on a superficial level. That was okay though. When I told them I was going on a writer's retreat, Em said I had more money than sense, even though I never told her how much it cost. Izzy said it was lovely that I had a hobby and was sure I would enjoy it. I told them it wasn't a hobby. My hobbies are theatre, cinema and wool crochet. I wanted to be a published author. They laughed. Em said, "Don't we all?" Izzy saw my face though and said, "It was good to have a goal, but try not to be too disappointed if it didn't happen." I changed the subject then because it came obvious that I was either not going to get the cheerleading I would have liked, or I was making a huge mistake. When I finished my sad, sorry story, I was waiting for Millie to say the quickest thing she needed to say to remove herself from the seat next to me and enjoy the party more. She didn't. She said something I did not see come in. "Your friends love you very much." Had she just not listened to what I said? She must have seen my confusion, so continued. "They just want to keep you safe. Wrap you up in cotton wool and make sure you don't get hurt." "Well, that never works," I replied. She laughed. "Nope. Heard it sounds like you've made the decision not to play it safe anymore, so I expect a lot more pushback." Which obviously wasn't great news. "You've made the point that they are partners and you don't. Are you dating?" One of those heart-sink questions about why aren't you with someone, when the truthful answer is, I've never met someone who I really liked and who really liked me. I told her that I was still seeing Ben, which is obviously dating in the loosest sense because we skipped right to the end of the night stuff. She knew all about Ben, which meant she had actually listened to my podcast and not just said she had. She encouraged me to go on a few dates and have fun, see what happened. I was too old for all that nonsense, so I told her that it was a bit late for me. She said to me, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realise you were dead. But if you're not, then it's not too late." Millie pointed out a guy across the room. "He's been looking over here, so he's definitely into one of us. I'm going to find out which one." And she got up and sidled over. I didn't even watch. It was definitely her. It seemed in no time at all that people were leaving to catch trains and the night was drawing to a close. It was only about 8:30, 9 o'clock, but there it was. I found Lauren again and told her what an awesome superstar she was and she should be immensely proud. Tyler found me and asked if I wanted to go for food before going back to the hotel. We ended up in one of those restaurants just off Leicester Square. He is super enthusiastic about writing, even the lows of it, and it was just so satisfying talking about it. At one point he asked me about my work in progress and I said 40,000 words and added, because I couldn't help it, of utter shite. He laughed and said, "It's your first draft, it's gonna be shite." When I got back to the hotel room, it was gone 11 p.m, but I felt on cloud nine. Simply happy, satisfied, so pleased I made the effort to come, and above all, slightly drunk. I remembered my phone was still in airplane mode, so I switched that off and the beep started. Loads of enthusiastic messages from the Writers Retreat gang. Can we be called a gang? Okay, group might sound better. Anyway, the group telling each other how great it was to see each other and we needed to do it again soon. Then there was a direct message from Millie saying, "I know you're having a tough time, but just remember you are totally flipping brilliant." Then there was a picture of her and that guy from the party. And the last message was, "I'm going to ask if he has a friend for you." It made me laugh anyway, and I replied back to the group message, telling them it was amazing to see them all. Then I messaged Millie back, thanking her for the chat tonight and to have a good night. There was a text sat there from Izzy, but I was leaving it until last because I was dreading what I'd said. I couldn't ignore it. It just said, "Em's told me what happened. Please ignore her, and I will speak to you soon. Enjoy London," and there was a row of kisses. There was nothing from Em's. Ray Davies sang, "But I don't feel afraid. As long as I gaze at Waterloo sunset, I am in paradise." I don't think there's a more perfect lyric. The journey back started okay and I was enthused with ideas about my story. As soon as the coach passed over the Prince of Wales Bridge, though, I started to have that sinking feeling. The fact that I would have to face work again tomorrow and what that meant. I hadn't made the decision, or I had, but I was still being an ostrich about it. Plus Em's, I wasn't in the mood for her being in the mood. After I returned home, I unpacked and decided to make myself a mug of tea and watch some TV to switch off. It was only when I settled in my chair for a few minutes, reached towards my mug, and picked up a carton of milk, I realised two things. I had made the decision about work, and my tea was currently sat in the fridge where the milk should be. That's enough from me. Thank you so much for listening. It just leaves me to say, please come back. I'm not needy or anything, but do what you want. Also, a lot of this stuff is from the internet, and did you know the internet can lie? You can find me on Instagram at excusejess, and let's do this again soon.
Excuse the Jess was written and performed by Jackie J. Sarah. It is a Deliciously Bright production. If you enjoyed this, please click follow and give us a 5-star review or donate via Buy Me a Coffee. All details, including full credits, can be found on the website excusethejess.com.